Welcome to the latest episode of the DebtWired podcast. I'm David Orbai-Graves, senior reporter at DebtWire Europe, and I'm delighted to be joined by Fabian Krobog, the founder and chief investment officer of Northwall Capital, a European credit fund focused on private markets. Welcome, Fabian. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Hi, David. Nice to see you.
Perhaps you can kick things off with a bit of background about yourself and about Northwall.
I started my career originally as an investment banker in the early 2000s in New York, working at Bear Stearns and then Goldman in London. I have been an investor in European credit, predominantly private credit, for 20 years this year. Before launching Northwall, I was a founding partner at a distressed investor called Warwick Capital, having spun out of another credit firm, a credit multi-strategy. Hedge funds were really the credit team previously. Northwall, like you point out, is exclusively focused on private markets. We manage today just under 3 billion euros. We have 40 people based in London, but have well advanced plans for international expansion. More on that later. And as a firm, we are focused on private credit with a strong focus on downside protection and delivering good risk adjusted returns to our investors.
So perhaps you can tell us what kind of strategies the firm runs and what sort of opportunities you look at.
Our flagship strategy is our credit opportunity strategy. That strategy is focused predominantly on the provision of private credit capital solutions to Western European borrowers experiencing an element of what we call situational complexity. There's a lot of private equity businesses in there, private equity backed businesses in there. You know, it tends to be all credit, tends to be all first and second lien. We recently had a first close of our second strategy, our senior lending strategy. That senior lending strategy invests in senior-only capital structures, again, focused on corporate borrowers with a slightly lower return target than the credit ops strategy. We have two spin-out strategies that came out of our credit opportunities fund. When that fund hit concentration limits, we saw that as an opportunity to launch dedicated products. One is our asset-backed strategy that invests predominantly in financial assets, large portfolios of financial assets. And our second one is our legal assets strategy. That strategy lends to law firms that are involved in some very large multinational litigations. And that altogether employs the same approach. We are very focused on downside protection, heavily structured deals, good upside optionality, and managed by one cohesive team here of credit experts.
Broadly speaking, are you able to kind of give any guidance around what your return expectations are like across the strategies?
Of course. You look, on the credit ops side, because we do deal with slightly more complex situations, you know, we target a mid to high teens returns to maturity, which if you get a little bit lucky, can end up in a high teens, even low 20s return to the first call, although we have some flexibility here. In our senior lending strategy, we target a net return now in the double digits, though that strategy can use a little bit of leverage and generally is just targeting lower returns. Our asset-backed strategy targets high teens, though we've today pretty significantly outperformed that. And our loans to law firm strategy is a money multiple driven strategy. So we're looking here at 2 to 3 times money multiples and IRRs north of 20% gross IRRs.
And as you mentioned before, AUM surpassed 2.9 billion euros in June. What do you think is driving LPs to allocate to European private credit? Is it a case of US LPs having more money to work and having to look further afield? Or is it a specific pull factor towards European private credit?
We've experienced a period of exceptional growth. I think more than half of our AUM was raised this year, although obviously was the result of many years of work. I think there are a few things going on when you think about Europe at the moment. I think the first thing is there's a very natural cycle that I've observed over many decades in this industry. When there is a recovery, which such as the recovery that we experienced after COVID, tends to focus first of the US, then it moves to Europe, then to Asia. So there is definitely a sense amongst our investors that a lot of the opportunity in the US market has played through. And what we started to see about 2 years ago is the larger institutional investors, predominantly North American investors, that have that institutional memory and that experience, were already starting to look towards Europe, Western Europe, as the next way to outperform potentially their peers and to meet their own expectations. Then what has happened more recently has been the fact that, again, predominantly North American LPs now are forced to view Europe not just as a nice-to-have diversifier, but a core component of allocation. Because everything that makes, and I'm a European, so everything that makes us a little bit dysfunctional, the slowness in the decision-making process, the indecisiveness of the European Union, the difficult politics we have here, that also leads to a more predictable outcome. You can't have single individual political leaders change policy on a whim. And that has now made Europe a potentially more stable place to invest, if you had any doubts before that. The huge amount of spending coming out of Germany, the potential for real economic growth in Germany, the renewed focus on defense spending, now has also created a potential narrative for Europe to be a growing market, which is something that we really haven't had for a long period of time. Now, finally, I think we also have to get a little bit of credit and take a little bit of credit for, you know, the Northwall specific factors. Starting one of these businesses is extremely difficult. We're now 7 years in. Our third credit ops fund has a fairly material target number on it that opens you up to a different type of institutional LP. We've delivered very strong returns, very strong realizations. We have done this while demonstrating scalability, and we're a multi-fund, multi-vintage credit shop platform that offers you a one-stop solution to all sorts of European and all types of European credit. And that has really changed the way that our investors have viewed us as well.
When we spoke earlier, you mentioned that providing new money is the new distressed debt investing. Perhaps you can tell us a bit more about your thinking around this.
I started my career originally on the credit side, trying to invest in European distressed markets. And I've just found the European secondary credit market to be an extremely difficult place to make consistently outsized returns while also delivering scalability, right? Which ultimately is something that's very important to me. We've kind of come to the conclusion that traditional distress in Europe is a market opportunity. It's not an asset class. There are just fewer sellers of risk at a time and in a way and at a price where we would want to buy it. So when we look ahead and we kind of think a little bit about, you know, if there was to be widespread distress in this industry, how would that express itself? I was having a conversation about this with somebody the other day that wanted to understand how they could potentially broker some of these private credit loans. And it's very unlikely that these direct lenders will ever be forced to sell individual positions at a large discount to par. The simple reason is they have all the time in the world in their funds. They can always give fund extensions. There is no regulatory drive to de-risk their portfolios. So what's going to happen ultimately when these businesses need to generate, when these businesses need to raise additional cash, it's going to have to come in the form of new money. And when this new money comes and the private credit firm is tapped out, they've made a bunch of poor lending decisions, the investors are no longer backing them with new capital, it's going to be relatively straightforward for some of these weaker structures for investors to prime the existing capital structure and provide the necessary liquidity that might be needed. So the docks are looser and the lenders might want to allow another person in the capital structure. And even if not, they might not have a choice.
Would you ever get involved in a situation where you're taking advantage of those loose documents or to provide the priming money? Or are you more focused on finding opportunities where the dynamics are a bit more consensual?
Everything that we do at Northwall, we've just taken the view that we prefer partnership over animosity. It just makes good business sense. We like to lend money, get paid back. We like to work with people rather than against them. It leads to more predictable outcomes. There might be a time, though, and I do not want to preclude that time, when a company, in order to survive, needs to raise money, needs to find a solution, and the existing incumbent lender is unable to provide that. Would we work in a way that ensures the survival of the company? We would consider it. Though in my personal experience, David, it's very difficult to push an existing lender out that doesn't want to be pushed out, right? Because they do have the ability to frustrate things.
And I get the impression that your opportunistic credit strategy is focused on lending to companies which are facing some sort of idiosyncratic challenges and have limited access to capital, but perhaps their fundamentals remain resilient. Can you think of or give any kind of examples of the types of challenges that a company might face that would lead to that kind of dislocation?
Of course. I mean, the commonality, like you've pointed out in our transactions, is that there is a relatively urgent requirement for capital. What we can offer is transaction certainty and speed of execution. And in exchange for that, we're going to be a little bit more expensive and we're going to have proper documentation. The investment committee of Northwall consists of myself and my partner, Alex. That means we can take decisions very, very quickly. We have a collaborative approach here, where there are a lot of different opinions in the room that help us get something done. If maybe I don't understand the credit well enough, or Alex, there are very smart people here whose judgment we trust. And the main drivers can involve very often a purchase of an asset where one of the lending banks dropped out of the process at the last minute, leaving a hole in the capital structure. So for example, a deal we did called Project North, it was a new acquisition. The sponsor had spent 18 months chasing the deal. They were finally awarded the mandate. They were 4 weeks away from closing, and a commercial lending bank just dropped out. So they came to us and said, look, we need to replace this commercial lending bank. Can we structure an agreement, you know, that meets your return expectations, where you just slot into the capital structure and get it done? Another situation that we might get involved in is a equity raise or even an outright sale of a business where people just didn't get the price or the valuation they wanted to. So we recently did an insurance related deal closed earlier this year where they got bid, let's call it 15 times or 10 times EBITDA. But because of the growth that we're expecting in the business, they thought that that materially undervalued the business. So they came to us and said, look, rather than sell the business today, we'd like to refinance our incumbent. They're now overdue. We need another 2 to 3 years. Will you structure something? And so we structured something with them that gave them the additional 2 or 3 years to grow the business. We think we got very good risk reward. There's a relatively long non-call. And after 3 years, you know, hopefully they will have ended up generating much better returns. And so will we have. And then kind of the third driver that's very common, just another type of urgent financing. So an award of a company, because you were the second highest bidder after the first bidder dropped out. Now you have 4 weeks to close something, and it doesn't really matter because you bid a low price just to find a way to get it done. You want somebody like Northwell. And what we can offer you is you can come in, you can look at the chief investment officer, you can look at Alex, and you know we're going to tell you that provided the diligence checks out, you have no investment committee risk, and people are willing to pay for that. It is very situational, but it's proven to be very scalable and very repeatable.
You previously touched on weak credit documentation. I'd be interested to find out a little bit more about what approaches you take to protecting yourself. Is it, you know, primarily by tightening up the docs and covenants, or is it kind of structural considerations, enhanced diligence, a mix of all of the above?
Look, David, in my experience, I've tried every approach to mitigate risk. And the conclusion that I have come to is that there is no better way to mitigate risk than underwriting a business properly and making sure that you get the diligence, right? No amount of structural protections or covenants will protect you against an underwriting mistake that you have made. So for us, it really starts with what information do we have? What's the quality? What's the access to management? And spending a lot of time trying to understand the business. One of the potentially unexpected nuances of our approach is that because of the urgency in our situations, we tend to get much better access to management. Because for us to conduct diligence on a project, you need to give us exclusivity, cost coverage, and usually a break fee. And that means that we're all committed to getting something done together. So we have very good access, not only to the company's team, but also usually the private equity firm, their team, their advisors, etc. So combination of underwriting based on good information. Now, the next step is structuring a deal in a way where you have a single point of enforcement, you have covenants that matter and that will trigger before your capital is impaired. Yeah, what that means in practice is if I'm impaired at 6 times and my covenant allows for up to 8 times leverage, the covenant is completely worthless, right? And so in all of the situations that we deal with, we make sure that we have a business plan that we all believe in and covenants that force them to adhere to it. And so, you know, what that means in practice is that, you know, our documents tend to be good. We are very focused on downside risk and detection. And it doesn't mean that if something goes wrong, we're not prepared to work with our counterparties. Quite the opposite. We always want to take a partnership and consensual approach. But worst comes to worst, you know, we will do what it takes to protect our investment.
One recently announced transaction was the acquisition of a large securitization of NPL assets from Lowell. Can you tell us a bit more about the transaction and how it was structured?
We have had a very good partnership with the team at Lowell over the years. We've transacted with them a few times. As you will have reported and will have likely seen, you know, this transaction was structured as a securitization. In fact, it was 2 separate securitizations. In one securitization, we only bought the junior notes. In one securitization, we bought the junior and the senior notes. You know, this transaction included some other bells and whistles around servicing agreement that is very favorable to both parties in the sense that it gives Lowell the certainty that they will receive the cash from us for servicing the portfolio for some time, while providing us with the necessary protection in case things go wrong, but at the same time also linking the ultimate cost of servicing to the performance of the underlying investment.
When it comes to NPL purchases, you know, aside from returns, what kind of criteria do you apply when you're looking at an opportunity? What's more important? Is it the nature of the underlying assets, the structuring of the particular securitization regulation in the particular jurisdiction?
All of these things are obviously very, very important. We have historically, and the Wolf 4 transaction is a little bit different in that respect, at least on a portion of the portfolio. We've really been focused on reperforming or almost reperforming portfolios. The commonality of the portfolios that we've invested in has been that some of them have been well seasoned, and some of them, you know, we bought a portfolio in Germany that had been seasoned over 12 years. So what we are focused on acquiring is the long tail, where the cash flows are more predictable. When you buy something that is where you are really in the long tail, the underlying, I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but it matters less, because here it tends to be people that have agreed to go on payment plans and are making monthly payments that are going to come to a natural event and eventually, but actually just continue to pay with a high degree of certainty. So here, our underwriting really focuses on what's the predictability of the cash flow streams, right? And like I alluded to in regards to the Wolf 4 transaction, is there's nobody that knows this portfolio better than the seller of the portfolio, in the case of Lowell especially. Now, the way that you can ensure that you are aligned is that you agree to buy into the business plan of your counterparty, obviously having underwritten it yourself, but that you then link the servicing revenues, our servicing expenses, to the performance of the portfolio. And so far in our partnership with Lowell, I don't say this lightly, I have been extremely impressed by the quality of their ability to predict the cash flow streams in the ERC. Of course, we also spend a lot of time thinking about what's the regulatory environment in which you operate, especially in the UK. That's particularly relevant to make sure that we are on the right side of the rule of law.
As you know, debt collectors are frequent issuers of corporate debt in the high yield markets. And I think it's fair to say the sector has had a tough few years. You perhaps kind of touched on it in terms of the linking of the servicing revenues with the performance, but to what extent do you factor in the creditworthiness of the actual debt collector itself when you're looking at an investment like an NPL portfolio or securitization?
Everything that has ever gone wrong for me in the last 15 years was related to the quality of the counterparty. We are extremely sensitive to the quality of the underlying servicer. Thankfully, there's a lot of information in the public domain on Lowell, and we've spent a lot of time looking through, making sure that we were comfortable with the potential risk. There's a few things. In the case of the Wolf 4 portfolio, we were part of the solution by giving the company the cash it needed potentially ahead of time to meet some of its maturities. We had a high degree of confidence that the counterparty could operate, deliver operationally. That allowed us the possibility to place a higher amount of reliance on who we were dealing with, at least that perspective. But I think most importantly, the conclusion that we came to ultimately is that if Lowell were to restructure its bonds again, it was very likely not going to impact the servicing capabilities at the various subsidiary entities where we're involved. Only a very aggressive liquidation, which I don't think is anybody's interest, and the wind down of operating entities would ever lead to an impairment from that angle. You know, we are a big customer of Lowell's, and, you know, we believe that it's going to always be important that Northwall is happy with the relationship. And we are. And if it ever were to endanger our ability to manage our investors' capital, we obviously have the necessary protections.
The Wolf 4 deal was the latest and largest of a number of deals that you struck with Lowell. And I've also heard you talk in previous interviews about how Northwall approaches European credit by starting small with a counterparty before expanding the relationship with successively larger transactions. Why do you think this is a particularly successful approach, specifically in the European context?
Look, I think, first of all, in Europe, it's so difficult to deploy large amounts of capital, especially in deals like this. They're just very, very rare. And counterparties in Europe want to know who you are. It is very much a relationship-focused business. They want to know that over the next few years when they're dealing with you, you know, you're going to be around, the same person is going to be talking to you. And this is what also makes Northwall so unique, because we've literally had almost no turnover at this firm since inception. So there's that commonality of people. What I've also learned is that when you go into something new, you know, law firm lending, portfolios, it's best to start small so you get to know each other and you build comfort with the asset class. So the first deal that we did in this particular market was 8 million euros. It's a Danish deal. So it's tiny. While over the last 18 months, we've now deployed nearly half a billion euros of capital into this space. It's just a much better way of scaling up. And by the way, that applies also to our credit ops business. You know, there are counterparties with whom we've done our first deal is 25 million. We're making some exceptions and breaking our internal sizing rules. But then over time, we've built those relationships to deploy 100 million euros plus. And they keep coming back to us for more deal flow and more deal flow because they know that we'll do exactly what we told them we were going to do.
Another situation where you've taken this sort of incremental approach is, and I think you alluded to it earlier, is you're lending to law firm Bogus Goodhead, which were loans which now refinanced by Gramercy, secured against a portfolio of the firm's lawsuits, which are kind of mainly mass tort cases. Can you walk us through your approach to financing legal assets?
The legal assets landscape breaks down into two groups, broadly speaking. You've got litigation funders that are run by litigators, and they don't have a lot of experience of managing credit risk. And on the other side, you've got credit funds that maybe don't have enough lawyers. I think what makes our proposition to our counterparties unique is that we have very experienced litigators supported by real credit analysts with a distressed approach to the world, meaning looking for downside risk at all times. What we tend to do is we tend to put an analyst together with a litigator, and the analyst will look at the law firm as if it's any other business, whether when the cash flow is coming through, what do we need to believe in, by what time, in order to be able to meet our liabilities. We then have the litigator looking at the probability of success and the individual cases. We have our structuring lawyers making sure that we're the last money in, first money out. We have our operations team going in, conducting operational due diligence on the asset, on the company, to make sure that the cash controls are right, the budgeting is okay, that they understand really how to run the business from a business perspective. And we put all of this together, you know, we have a fairly unique approach to litigation funding. What are we trying to do is we're trying to create credit-like risk profile from legal assets investment. And what that means, we need downside protection. So we need more than one asset, so multiple different litigations. We need downside protection. We want to manage the duration risk. So if you invest in a portfolio of cases, some have been running for 3 years, some have been running for 3 months, and some for 5 years, that shortens the total duration of the portfolio. You know, and then we want to have the semblance of a contractual return, which is what we always say is last money in, first money out, some split to the partners, maybe if they need it. But the reality is, you know, we're coming in, we'll let you take money out once we've been repaid with some sort of return. That approach makes us unique, I think, in the world of legal assets financing, and it's worked out really well for us. Just a second point, again, coming back to our earlier discussion on sizing, our relationship with Bogus Goodhead started with a £5 million transaction that we then scaled up by £50 million and then scaled up by another £100 million. So at the time, our total investment in the firm went all the way up to $186 million, which is very sizable exposure for us or really anybody.
Just to delve a little bit further into the point you made there about how you protect against the downside risk by having a portfolio of assets there, I'm quite curious what happens to assets in this specific case, which are legal claims, if in a distressed situation or kind of an insolvency of the law firm. What happens in that scenario? Do you then take over the legal claims and have to appoint a replacement counsel, or how does that work? Because the lawsuit has been brought by in these kind of mass tort cases, I guess, has been helped along the way by the law firm itself. How do you get your kind of protection there if the law firm kind of disappears?
When these individuals, in the case of mass torts or companies, in the case of kind of commercial claims, sign up to a funding agreement, to a law firm agreement, they are bound effectively to work with that law firm. We have security against the cash flows that come from those funding arrangements. you know, those funding arrangements are, in theory, transferable. Of course, much easier thing to do with the support of your law firm than against their wishes, right? So what you effectively have to do here, much more than in say, a plain vanilla corporate loan, is establish a direct contractual nexus between you as lender and the managing partners of the law firm. Then the other protective mechanism that you implement in these situations is that you tend to have the control so long as you have the cash. We tend to disperse capital in line with pre-approved budgets so that if there's a massive cost overrun, you know, we can engage in a conversation around what we're going to do to stem that cost overrun. That being said, we, of course, do not want to be in a situation where a company, a law firm goes insolvent. It would create a huge amount of problems. So you have to leave yourself a little bit of a headroom to provide additional capital if that's necessary. We are definitely the type of firm that very happily defends its position.
And a final question, Fabian, we'll have to keep it quite brief because we're running out of time here, but are you able to offer your outlook for the broader macro picture? Where do you see European credit markets being by the end of this year?
The reason I sleep so well at night is that I don't try and predict the future. I'm an optimist on Europe, but you know, our whole business is structured in a way where we're not depending on crossover being at a certain level, high yield spreads being at a certain level. What we care about is having good relationships with our counterparties and having them come to us again and again to borrow more money. And they will keep doing that.
A lot to consider there, Fabian. Thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts today.
Great to be here.
This has been the DebtWired podcast with our guest, Fabian Krobog of Northwall Capital. Please do subscribe to receive all the latest insights from the DebtWire team.